Welcome to the AquariumMax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 95, recorded January 9th, 2012. Look, I did it again! I said 2012 again! Yay for me!
Twice in a row, not bad. We have a special show today.
We have Carlos with us.
Yes.
Again, yay!
Yep, this is his second interview with us. So welcome, Carlos.
Hi, Russ and Kelly. How are you guys?
We're doing well, and we're very glad to have you on the show.
I'm glad to be on. Thanks for asking me to be on.
Yeah, we did an interview with you a while ago on pumpkin seed sunfish, as not for your benefit, of course. You remember that well, I'm sure. But for those of you who may not have heard that show, we did one a while ago, so check out our archive and listen to that. But at the time, we spoke with Carlos about his interest and experience with bettas and thought we'd do a show on spawning bettas sometime, and this is that show. So here we are. We'll start out then, Carlos, just asking you a little bit about bettas, because it seems like, from what I've learned, I've kept quite a few bettas over the years, but the last time I tried to spawn them, I was about 13, and it didn't quite work out at the time. The male ate the eggs, and that was the end of that, and I haven't gone back to it, not because I'm not interested, but just because I haven't had the chance to go back. But I'm sort of digressing, so I'll go a different direction now. I've noticed that betta care has a lot of aspects that many people agree on, you know, some of them, and other people just hotly debate other ones. So what would you say, based on your experience and so on, what would you say are a few of the crucial points of betta care that are different from those points on, with many other aquarium fish?
Well, I would say some of the things that make bettas a little more unusual than other fish is the fact that they can be kept in smaller volumes of water. You don't really need a 10-gallon tank to keep a betta in. I don't often keep bettas in my community tanks except for maybe the occasional female. So I think the fact that they're kept in smaller containers presents this big difference in why people like to keep bettas. But I think part of the important thing about knowing about keeping them in a small container is that they really need to be kept at a warmer temperature, somewhere between 75 and 80 degrees, which is probably not room temperature for most people. So that presents a small problem there.
Especially since it's hard to get small heaters.
Yes, there's small heaters. There's a couple ways of doing things. In the summertime, definitely room temperature is perfectly okay. I keep most of mine upstairs in the living room. I like to scatter them around the house because they're nice to look at. But in the winter, everybody's all in one spot, nice and warm.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I've got some at work now that I have situated in a spot that's the warmest spot that I could possibly find, and they are a toasty about 82 degrees right now. So that, but it's hard to find spots like that.
It is. What I do, you know, some people have very going back to your last show. Some people have very elaborate fish rooms with heated water drip systems and everything that runs through one sump, and then the water filters back and trickles into each individual betta container. Well, I'm not handy enough for something like that, so what I do is I keep my male bettas, I keep them in separate jars, mostly like whatever glass jars instant coffee come in or mayonnaise jars, and I keep them in big Rubbermaid containers, kind of what you use to, like a sweater box, and I put a heater, I fill that about halfway with water, well, not even halfway, just a couple inches, and I keep a submersible heater in there, and I can keep about 15 jars per container, and they're all heated at the same temperature.
It's a good idea.
Yeah. Now, when you do that, do you need to use a pump or an airstone or something to keep the water circulating, or does it work without one?
No, it just works without one, and obviously, then what I have to do is, because they're in those small containers and I don't have any kind of centralized filtration system, I do do water changes individually on each of them every 2 to 3 days.
Okay. And how many setups do you have like that? How many of the sweater box containers do you usually
have?
Well,
I have about 3 of them. Right now, only one of them is currently in use. I've only got about 10 males right now.
Okay.
Is that a lower number for you? How many do you usually have?
Well, I've had to dial it back now. The kids are a little older, and with all this college visiting and everything, I haven't had as much time for a large volume of that is. But I've had upwards of 30 to 40 males at one time.
Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. It really, I mean, you have to be really dedicated, and a lot of people that decide they want to breed bettas seriously to show or for whatever reason, a lot of people get burnt out fast and end up giving it up altogether. And I almost got to that point, so instead I just dialed it way back and do 2 or 3 spawns a year and just take it easy and enjoy it, really. Because if it gets too stressful, then it's really not fun.
Right.
Yeah, and if it's not fun, what's the point?
Exactly.
You have to find that point where it's still fun.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, are there any other points? You mentioned that the size of the container and the temperature. Any other crucial points you'd like to mention?
Well, I think water changes are really crucial. Definitely, I mean, once a week is the bare minimum. I highly suggest 2 to 3 times a week. And if you can do that, along with decent food, bettas can live for a pretty long time.
And how long would you say is the upper limit of lifespan that you can expect?
Well, I would say the upper average is 2 to 2.5 years. I've had, especially females. For me, for some reason, the females are a little hardier. But I've had bettas live for up to 4 years.
Hmm, nice. Yeah, I've heard records of 5. I don't know if those have been substantiated or not, but I've heard about that. So, but 4, that's longer than I've ever kept a betta for sure.
It's not very common. Like I said, very, very. The average is definitely around 2 years. Actually, I gave one to my niece, and she's had it for 3.
Wow!
So I'm surprised that it's still alive every time I go over there.
Now, when you find bettas in pet stores, they're typically probably 6 months old or more. Is that, you think that's probably right, or depends on the situation?
I would say so, although lately I've been noticing that a lot of them are quite small, so I would put the age probably to around 3 or 4 months.
Oh, okay.
Russ actually just got a really teeny one.
Yeah,
from the pet store.
I noticed that this pet store was selling... They had labeled them as baby bettas, and they were very, very small, which is, so I'd never seen any this small before. There was one that's from the mouth to the end of the caudal peduncle was probably 3/4 of an inch long.
Wow, that is small.
Yeah, I'd never seen one like that before. But typically, I guess they're a bit older than that. All right, well, I think we've covered probably most of the crucial points of betta care in general, so let's... hit our next question. What are the most important points to ponder in relation to spawning bettas before you even get your breeding stock? What should you have in mind?
I think probably the most important thing is to really kind of, unless you're doing it just for the experience of spawning bettas, just think about what you're looking to get out of it. There's incredible amount of colors and fin types, so kind of stick to one, or you end up getting overwhelmed by all the different possibilities.
Yeah, it must be hard to choose one. There are so many amazing fish out there.
It's extremely hard to choose, actually. But if you like crown tails, you know, you could decide you want to breed crown tail bettas or spot guts or blue bettas or red bettas. So yeah, just have them go in more or less having an idea of what you're looking for, what you want the offspring to look like, what you're going to do with those offspring.
Yeah,
maybe,
that's
maybe Apple can come up with an app of design your betta ahead of time, and you can go through and like customize an ideal betta.
Oh, if it were only that easy.
Yeah, if only they had an app for that.
This is your goal, your beta goal app.
That would be kind of neat, actually.
Yeah, maybe I should do that. So you need to look at what you need to choose your variety.
I think so.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then you need to decide what you want to get out of it, whether you're just spawning for fun or... And I really liked what you mentioned about what you're going to do with the fry, because I imagine that's the tricky part to a large extent.
It is, because obviously if you're into showing bettas, you're going to have lots, you're going to keep lots, because you have to wait until they get, I would say, at least 6 months old before you're sure that whatever color they look like are is fixed and, you know, competitive enough to send to a show. But if not, pet stores, you know, my fish store will take a certain amount, but if I go in there every month, they're like, all right, the betta shelf is kind of full. You got anything else? So, unless you have a lot of relatives, like for me, fortunately, there's a lot of little kids in my family, so I'm always...
You're the cool fishy uncle.
A few away, but yeah, you have to keep in mind, too, what you're going to do with all these fish, because there are a lot of them.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense, and it's easy to get to the point where pet stores become saturated.
Yeah, well, because the thing is, too, with bettas is, you know, they're usually displayed on a shelf or on a little table or something like that. It's not like breeding celestial pearl danios where you can go in with 24 and they'll take them off your hands faster than you can say, do you want these?
Right.
If you go in with 24 bettas, they already obviously probably have some that they've brought in themselves, so, you know, it becomes a question of space for them also.
Right, they can't toss 24 bettas together on the middle shelf like they could with celestial pearl danios or something like that. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Anything else you should think about before you start spawning?
Just, I don't know, I think that's about it, really.
Okay.
Alrighty, well, let's go on to step two. What should people be aware of when they're choosing and actually obtaining their breeding stock?
Well, again, it goes back to what your intentions are. If you're thinking about showing bettas, you really have to know the genetic history of the fish that you're purchasing. Because just because they're blue doesn't mean their parents were, and you could breed two blue bettas hoping for blue bettas and you get marbled, butterfly, multicolored, it could be anything. So it could be really frustrating if you're looking for a specific outcome.
So are there people that you obtain this breeding stock from, do they have pedigree charts that you can peruse when you're choosing your...
You have to do a little bit of research, and if you go with a reputable breeder, then yeah, they can go at least 5 generations back and let you know what the lineage is.
Okay.
But a lot of times, it's happened where you want turquoise bettas and they come from a marbled background and you get a lot of crazy, really cool, beautiful fish, actually. So it's not a bad thing, but it's bad if that's not what you want.
Right.
Right, right. So you can, it's sort of a grab bag and there can be stuff in there, but just not what you expected.
Yeah.
Now, I've heard that there are some things like lethal genes in some of the beta strains, too. Like some of the black strains, I think. You can end up with...
Yeah.
You can't breed certain ones together, something like that?
Well, black bettas, which are called Milano in the betta breeder talk, black Milano females are infertile.
Okay. Hmm.
So if you breed two black bettas together, you will not get a viable spawn. You usually have to breed a black male to a dark blue, and then you'll end up with some dark blue, some black. So that's why black bettas in the show circuits are very hard to come by, a pure, good-looking black betta.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, it's
and
time for our break.
Genetic problems also, like with the half moon. A lot of the half moons have been so inbred that there's a whole rose tail mutation, which is kind of ugly and bad.
Okay, what's the one that...
Inbreeding goes on.
What is the one that you showed me that I just thought was the dumbest looking tail?
Which one?
It looks like a butt. It looks like a butt tail. That's what I said.
The double tail?
The double tail. I think it looks like a butt.
Okay.
It's tough. It depends on the volume of the double tail. Sometimes it's two very weak little lobes, but if you get a really full, good, overlapping double tail, it looks like one giant, massive fan. So those are really beautiful.
I'll have to see one like that, because apparently the pet store double tails just look like plumber's crack to me.
Well. That's a pretty good way of looking at it.
And one thing, too, to remember is when you go to the pet store, you see bettas, they're almost all culls.
Yeah, yeah.
Of, you know, breeders' mm-hmm. culls or whatever, if they're not indeed less than that. But when you see, like, half moons at a pet store, they're typically breeder culls, isn't that right?
That's true for the most part. And the other thing, too, is with a lot of the bettas being bred, you know, in the southeast in Asia, what they do is they just have massive breeding pools because they spawn them outside in ponds, so they throw in a bunch of fish and at the end of a couple months just drag a net out and start bagging them.
Wow.
That's why you get such interesting variations and multicolored mixes and so on.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. And I've noticed in recent years it's changed, but it used to be all you would ever find were veil tails, and they were just about any color combination you could possibly imagine, but that's all you'd get. And then in recent years, we've been able to see a lot more of the crown tails and the half moons and the placots and so on.
Yes, it's surprising. I have found a lot of really, really beautiful fish just in, you know, the big box pet stores. I never thought I would ever buy a betta from something, one of those places, but I have gotten my last few from there, actually.
It's come a long way.
It has, yeah. I was there the other day at one of the big box stores and saw a placot butterfly male, and I just thought, oh, I wish I had space for that one.
Yeah. Yeah, I recently bought a Cambodian dragon placot, and its whole body is looks like a knight's armor, opaque, metallic look with red fins.
Cool.
Wow.
Gorgeous.
Wow. Yeah, I'm glad that they have kind of increased the selection lately in the pet stores. Okay, well, let's look at our next question, I guess. What equipment should one have in hand when you're about to spawn bettas?
All right, if you decide that spawning bettas is for you, I recommend that you get a 5 or 10-gallon tank, a submersible heater, and a sponge filter, and an overhead light, some kind of lighting. You're probably... To spawn the bettas, you're just going to fill the tank up about 4 inches because as they're spawning, the female drops the eggs and the male has to chase after them and scoop them up and spit them into the nest. So the less that he has to dive after them, the less tired he will be for the actual spawning.
Oh.
That's interesting. That's a good idea.
And so you want to keep the water at about 80 degrees. What else do you need? Live or artificial plants also are good to have because it gets a little, not violent, but, you know, they like to nip at each other and chase each other around, and sometimes the female gets a little tired during the whole courtship process and she needs a place to hide for a little while. So usually the females will hide behind the heater or behind the sponge filter. If you have some kind of plants, like I prefer to use Java moss, usually put a nice big clump somewhere near the back, and she'll dive in there and hide out for a while until she's ready to come back out and try it again.
Okay.
So, do you want to have some kind of live food source on hand for when the fry are ready for that, or do you have time still? I don't know how long it takes. So, I just remember when we were selling the worms, we get an awful lot of people saying, I need microworms right now, or my beta fry are all going to die!
That's the worst thing, is that sometimes, and I've definitely been guilty of it, you get really great fish, and your immediate thought is to just get them spawning as soon as possible without thinking ahead. So, yes, definitely, it's always a good thing to have live food on hand. When the eggs hatch, the fry are really tiny. The male will take care of them meticulously, spinning them up into the bubble nest. They'll fall out, he'll pick them back up. And after 2 or 3 days, they become self-sufficient and free swimming. So at that point, you want to take the male out, and they'll start swimming around. And if you have live plants, and if the sponge filter happens to be a seasoned filter, if the tank's been previously used, or if you use it from another tank, usually that provides a lot of infusoria for the little ones to start eating as their first foods. But about a day after they're free swimming, I add vinegar eels. So I always have a few cultures of vinegar eels going at all times. And then right about when they hatch, I start doing the newly hatched brine shrimp. I start getting the hatchery going, and about a couple days after they're free swimming, I start introducing some baby brine shrimp also.
Okay.
Okay.
Good.
Now, I've heard a lot of different things about microworms for bettas, for baby bettas. Some people say that it can cause problems with ventral fin development. Have you noticed that or heard about that or anything?
I've used microworms. I like microworms a lot, and so do baby bettas. And I don't think it's so much that the microworms cause this stunted ventral fin condition, but I think what happens is that microworms sink. So I think when they're down there looking around so much for them, or while they're eating, I think perhaps rubbing the fins or and rubbing their bellies against the bottom of the tank, where you get a lot of bacteria and waste, that perhaps that is what causes that. I don't think that it's the microworms themselves.
Okay.
Makes sense. It's kind of a secondary thing.
Yeah, some sort of secondary connection. That makes sense. Okay, and then I guess you have to have provision for jarring the babies when they come out?
Yeah, it all depends on how many. I don't ever do an infusoria culture because I kind of let nature take its course early on once they're on their own. So I believe in survival of the fittest, because if you have a spawn of 50, 60 newborns, I kind of let everything take its course until they whittle themselves down to about 20 or even less. That way it's a lot more manageable. And usually you wait, and you can raise them all together until the males are clearly showing male traits, you know, either the longer finnage, they grow a little bit faster, they start picking on the smaller ones and the other ones, and then you start jarring them. So yeah, it's definitely good to have a few jars on hand in anticipation. I used to have my mom give me all her coffee jars.
And it seems like that's a good method of making sure you don't have to do as much culling if you just let nature do some of that at the beginning.
That's true, because for me it's kind of hard. Like, even the last spawn I had, I ended up with 2 or 3 dwarfs, kind of like balloon molly shaped.
Oh, yeah.
They're nice fins, but they are just these stubby little bodies. But they're adorable, and I didn't have it in my heart to feed them to the sunnies. So my daughter took one to college, and I have another one, and my niece took another one.
And did they stay just dwarfed the whole time? I mean, even they're permanently like that?
Yeah, they're permanently stunted. They're about a half inch shorter than all their brethren, and they just have a very short, squat body.
Huh. They needed a little spider up above their tank writing words.
Some fish.
Some
right?
fish.
Terrific, radiant, humble fish. There you go.
But yeah, culling, unfortunately, sometimes is necessary. Sometimes you get some fish with crooked spines. If you're spawning, if you're breeding double tails, one of the defects of double tails is a bent spine down near the caudal peduncle. It gets kind of crooked one way or the other. So, unfortunately, if you look in a show or trying to raise show stock, they're not really good. So, the sunnies eat well.
Yeah, yeah, I imagine so. You've got to have...
Everybody's got to eat.
Something in place, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, so take us through, step by step, through the whole process from before you put the pair together to, well, I guess we kind of talked about feeding the fry a little bit, but, you know, finding home, you know, the whole actual process. Now that you've got your stock and you've got all your equipment set up, tell us what to do.
All right, so you've got your tank set up with, you know, a little bit less than half full. I like to let that sit with the filter going for a couple days, and then I'll introduce the male, and I'll let him spend about a day in the tank by himself, getting, you know, the lay of the land. I usually, at this point, add something that he's going to anchor the bubble nest to eventually, and one of the more popular things to do is to take a styrofoam cup and cut it in half so that when you float it, it looks like a cave, almost like a longhouse. But other things you can do is cut the bottoms off of the styrofoam cup so that you just have the little styrofoam circle or a 2x2 inch square piece of bubble wrap. It's kind of cool, too, because I think they think there's bubbles already, like it's already a nest, so it triggers that bubble blowing instinct a little quicker.
Everybody loves bubble wrap.
Yeah,
right? So I let him go in there for a day, and then I'll introduce the female. Some sources say with a glass chimney that you can find, like on a hurricane lamp kind of thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't have one of those, so what I use is just a small jar. I'll put her in there with a couple inches of water, and I'll just float the jar in the tank just to keep her safe from the male if she's not ready to spawn. And he'll see her and immediately start to flare his gills and his fins and dance around and try to attract her. And if she is attracted, she'll respond by showing vertical barring. On a dark, it's much easier to see on dark-colored fish. You'll just see really dark, broad stripes. And he'll go and start blowing bubbles underneath whatever it is that you give him to blow bubbles underneath. And once he blows the bubbles and she seems to respond, I just pour her right in. Usually within a day or two, they spawn. And now, the big thing is not to freak out when you see the male chasing this female everywhere, because she'll act really interested, they'll go back and forth, and then at some point, she's not interested, and this angers him a great deal, and he will terrorize her, chasing her all over the tank, and your first instinct is to yank her out. Don't yank her out. Just let nature take its course. It almost always comes up positively. I've had over 50 spawns and have only once had a male kill a female before they spawn, or at all for that matter. So once they spawn and they lay the eggs, and the spawning process is really worth the whole thing. That's the best part of the whole thing, in my opinion. Once the eggs are in the nest, you want to remove the female, because after that he will hurt her seriously if she's still present. So you remove her, and he'll spend the next couple days guarding that nest without even looking at you. You can walk right up to the tank, and usually they'll pay you no mind. Don't feed them during this process, because some people believe that maybe feeding them will trigger his appetite, and he may eat the eggs or the fry. Over the years, I have tried feeding them and not feeding them, and sometimes he'll eat the eggs for no reason. Sometimes they'll eat the eggs if you feed them, if you don't feed them, so you never really know.
Mm-hmm.
But just to play it safe, I don't feed them. And I also keep the light on 24 hours after the eggs are in the nest, because for some reason it is true, if you turn the lights off at night, the next morning there will be no eggs.
Hmm.
Huh.
That's odd.
That is odd.
Then after that, once the fry are free swimming after 2 or 3 days, I usually remove them. Now, I've kept the male in with the fry longer than that just to see what would happen. And sometimes he's a wonderful father for up to a week, and some reason, some of them, once the fry can swim on their own, decide they're now snacks. So to play it safe, after they're free swimming, remove the male and start introducing a bit of the live food. And then after a week, we'll baby's eating and swimming around is when you can start doing small water changes.
Oh, so you don't do water changes during that whole process at the beginning?
No, you don't usually. But for some reason, it's a tank that I've used right after spawning another pair or something, and it looks like it might need some cleaning. But no, not usually.
Okay.
I imagine that would mess up the nest.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, they're very sensitive. Oh, that's the other thing, too. Thank you for saying that. I usually don't have the sponge filter going. If I have it on while he's guarding the nest, it's at a very, very slow bubble, because you don't want too much turbulence to break the nest up.
Okay. Right.
And the styrofoam cup or the piece of bubble wrap helps somewhat with that, but it's not proof against a lot of turbulence, I imagine.
Right, yeah. It kind of keeps things... It kind of binds it, but if for any reason I have crazy cats that sometimes like to run into things or run on top of the tank, and they shake the water up a little, and you see eggs falling all over the place and the nest breaking apart, and a little frustrating.
Yeah, we know about cats on top of the tank.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so... when you get to the point of water changes, and that, I imagine the fryer is still on baby brine shrimp at this point?
Yes. So after that, after about 2 weeks old is when I really start doing a little bit larger volume water changes, about 20% every 2 or 3 days. And this is when they really start to grow quickly. And I would say at about 3 to 4 weeks. I mean, you can, even before that, if you don't have as much access to small live food, you can introduce dry powdered food. But what I do, for some reason, they don't always go to the surface to look for this, so usually I'll take some kind of like turkey baster or eyedropper and I'll flash, or you could just stick your finger in and swirl it around just so that it starts to drift and get into that middle water column where they seem to hang out. And they'll find the food a lot easier that way. But after 3 or 4 weeks, you can start giving them, to some of the bigger ones anyway, you can start introducing the normal betta pellets. Actually, Hikari makes a great food called micro pellets, which is a good intermediate between powdered food and betta pellets.
Oh, yes. I've used that for cardinal tetras and neons. I love that food. It's good stuff.
And then after that, they start to grow pretty quickly. In about 5 or 6 weeks, you can really start to notice the color patterns, and sexing the fish becomes much easier. The other tricky thing is, and another reason why it's important to keep up the water changes, is because more so in bettas than I've seen breeding anything else, theory is that some fry produce a growth-inhibiting hormone that keeps some fish stunted. So you, for some reason, it's always inevitable. You have 2 or 3 1-inch juveniles, and the rest are about half-inch big. So usually you start to also jar some of the bigger ones if it looks like they can actually eat any of the smaller ones.
Oh yeah, I've had that issue with cichlids sometimes. You get a few fry that just get huge immediately, and pretty soon they start eating their little siblings if you don't separate them.
Name those ones Brutus.
Yeah. Cool. And then it's just a matter once you've separated. Now I guess you can leave the females together indefinitely as long as you have enough of them. Is that right?
Yes, I have a 20-gallon female sorority tank that I call it, that I just put the females that I keep them all together. Not even necessarily sisters. Just most of them. I've never really had any problems with female bettas being together.
Cool. And how many do you have together?
Right now I have 9 of them.
That's good.
Yeah, I'm working on a project at work, and I'm thinking of with some bettas, and after it has concluded, I'm going to need to home for the betas, so it'll probably be me who'll be taking them home, I imagine, and thinking of putting them together in a 20-gallon. So do you think five of them would be okay, or?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah?
Okay.
Yeah, I have it. It is just a. I have a. It's a 20-gallon planted tank that really I just I keep the females in and some of the larger juveniles even before I'm certain whether they're male or female. I put them in there also, and it really isn't ever a problem. I've produced sometimes juvenile swordtails in there, so it's kind of like a little community female betta tank.
Cool. I think the sorority tank is appealing in that it's just nice to see bettas together, and you can get a lot of variety in the colors with the females, even if not quite as much variety in the finish.
It's, yes, that's very true. I have a couple of black lace. They're like black with greenish metallic iridescence. Two of those. I have a almost completely white one, a yellow one, another blue one, and they all swim around together and they flare at each other. There's definitely an alpha female, but definitely nothing along the lines of female together.
Right, where you have an alpha male and then you have everybody else who's in pieces.
Yes.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I guess we sort of covered the homing the juvenile fish already, mm-hmm. didn't we? So that's anything else we need to put in there about raising then?
No. I really I can't stress water changes enough. Though there was a time where I thought that because unfortunately a very common disease among betta fry that you get a big large amount of losses is to velvet.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time I thought I had bad velvet outbreaks, and it may very well have been, but I think part of it was because I wasn't doing quite as many water changes as I should have been doing.
So that would be the...
They were shriveling up, and it was really sad to see. Very trying ordeal. But I've noticed that since I've stepped up to at least three water changes a week, I haven't had that problem in the last four or five spawns.
So water changes would be the big one.
Yeah. For everything.
Yeah, it's...
Obvious concern. Water changes is the gospel.
Yep, that's true. You can prevent just about anything with enough water changes, it's true. All right. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add then?
No, I just think that if you like bettas and you're interested in spawning them, go ahead and try it. It's very simple. The egg layers that I have limited breeding expertise outside of bettas, but they're very, very simple. It's really almost a matter of, these are the proper steps to go through if you want to do it, and especially if it's your first time doing so. But I have just gotten, I have ordered a pair of bettas and thrown them in the tank the next day and had them spawn a day later. Mm-hmm. They're really, it can be very simple if you know what to look for and if you're careful.
Wow. Yeah, I've been tempted over the years to try again. When I get the right situation, I think I will eventually try it again. Because they're beautiful. They're definitely one of my favorite fish. I can't pick one favorite, but they're up there.
Yeah, they're just so charming. They really have little personalities. All bettas, you go near there and they want to be fed. They like attention. They're smart for a small fish. You usually attribute those characteristics to cichlids, but they definitely have good little personalities.
Right, they do have personalities more like a cichlid than a lot of other small fish, it's true. Okay, well, could you recommend any societies or clubs or websites for listeners who want to get their feet wetter?
Absolutely. I highly recommend that if you are bitten hard by the betta bug, it took me probably about 5 years before I realized that I had this horrible betta crazy sickness. Joined the International Betta Congress, the IBC. They've been around for 50 years. It's a wonderful organization. You meet a lot of great people, and you can get your hands on a lot of magnificent fish, and not just betta splendens, but a lot of wild-type bettas, all the different other betta species that there are. Most everybody's tremendously helpful. The shows are a lot of fun to attend if you get the opportunity to do so. And even if you're not into showing bettas, just the wealth of information that most of these breeders have is worth it. Yeah, I've been a member since 2003, so I'm coming up on 9 years. I am also a member of the Central New York Betta Club, which is an official chapter of the IBC, 2004, of which I've been the secretary and I'm the current IBC representative of the club, but we're a little dormant right now. We've got some lack of numbers. We don't have a lot of members right now, so it's kind of an up and down thing. You've got a lot of people that join and then drop out. Like I said, a lot of people get in over their heads and they try to do too many lines at once and they just get burnt out, and instead of cutting back, just cut out altogether.
Right.
But the IBC and the CNYBC have a Yahoo group that you can join if you happen to have a Yahoo username or email address. IBC and CNYBC both have Facebook pages also that we're always looking for people to ask questions, just share ideas and pictures and that kind of stuff. And my two favorite betta websites, if you want to know all the different color varieties, fin varieties, the genetics behind each of them, how to raise them, everything you want to know about bettas, one is bettysplendens.com, which is run by betta breeder Victoria Parnell Stark, I believe now, also. She's currently living out of the country, so she's kind of dropped back a little bit. She's not quite as active in selling and everything as she once was, but the website is still a wealth of information. And bettaterritory.nl is the website of Dutch breeder now I'm drawing a blank. Are you kidding me? It'll come to me. But definitely go to the website. This guy has just the most amazing website. He has pictures of the male and female, and then pictures of the actual spawning and the offspring and how they're developing over the weeks. It is far and away my favorite website.
Cool. I didn't think I'd ever heard of that one. Betty Splendens, I had seen a bit and perused that somewhat, but I'd never heard of. Now, so we have Betty, like Betty. Is that splendens.com, and then bettaterritory.nl?
NL.
Netherlands, right?
Yes, Netherlands, yeah.
Cool.
Joep van Esch, thank you. Now it came to me.
Oh, there we go.
What was the name again?
His name is Joep. It's spelled J-O-E-P, van Esch.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah, and he mostly specializes in placots, especially metallic blue placots.
Cool.
And now he's branching into reds and everything, but just, you can go and, you know, each progressive spawn, you know, click onto the parents, and it goes back to what their parents looked like, and it's just really so thoroughly well done that I check it at least once a week.
Cool. Yeah, I'm intrigued, I must admit. I'll have to check that out. Okay. Well, I think this has been a great show.
Yes, thank you for being with us.
Yeah.
I had so much fun. I love talking about fish.
We are glad, and it's infectious, and we hope everyone enjoys the show as much as we have. I'm sure they will. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. May the fish be with you. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.